So we won't study Torah today. That will, I'm sure, be a relief to you. Instead, let's talk about three things. First of all, I just want to make one or two comments about the TED conference that I went to, because I didn't actually get, didn't have a Torah class after the TED conference. I want to say something about that, and then let's talk about AIPAC. And then maybe if we have time, we'll say a word or two about Purim. I just wanted to say, I don't know if any of you know what TED is. I mean, some of you know what TED is, but I don't know if the rest of you know what TED is. TED is this conference that started off first in Monterey, and now it's worldwide. There's a TED Global. It's technology, education, and design, and it invites mostly scientists, although not exclusively, from all over the world to talk about their discoveries and so on. And people give TED Talks, and they're all over the web. Some very fascinating talks. I just saw one on the web the other day by this guy. You know those things called CAPTCHAs? That are letters that you have to type in when you go to a website that are slanted, and the reason that you do that is to prove that you're not a computer program that will like buy millions of tickets before you have a chance to buy one. And computer programs cannot as yet read those and write them. So I saw an amazing TED Talk the other day by the guy who invented them, that he said, you know, it occurred to me that we're wasting people's time, like 10, 15 seconds to type these things, and I was thinking, could we use that time? So he realized that digitizing books, there are many words that computers don't get or don't spell properly or whatever. So now you'll often see two CAPTCHAs, and it'll ask you to spell two words. One of them is the real one, although you don't know which, and one of them is actually digitizing a book. So every time you type that second one, you're digitizing a book. And he said, as a result, we've had 750 million people digitizing the world's books. He said the greatest cooperation that is possible in the world is through the internet, and you don't even know that you're doing it, and you spend a couple of seconds. I mean, talks like that at TED, which are quite remarkable. So I just wanted to tell you about one, because it was worth hearing, and it may actually be a sermon, but I'm here. So there was a woman named Tali Sharot, and I think she's originally from Israel, both by her name. I didn't get a chance to meet her. I met some very, very interesting people. But she's a Cambridge or Oxford, I don't remember which, and she's a neuroscientist. And she wanted to know which philosophy was true, that it's better to be a pessimist and expect bad things because then you'll be pleasantly surprised, or to be an optimist and expect good things even though you'll be disappointed. So she did a whole series of studies, and here's the upshot. It's much better to be an optimist for three reasons. The first reason that it's better to be an optimist is that anticipation in itself is a great pleasure. So she says, people prefer Friday to Sunday, because Friday you're looking forward to the weekend, and Sunday, even though you're not working, you keep thinking, tomorrow I gotta work. So anticipation's sometimes a greater pleasure than realization. The second reason, she said, is that pessimists put stress and worry on their system, which is in itself bad, that optimists don't, because they assume things are going to go badly. And the third reason is that in character tests, optimists, when something goes well, they attribute it to themselves. I studied for that test, but if something goes badly, they attribute it to circumstance. Oh, it was a hard test. Pessimists do just the opposite. They say, if they do well, I was just lucky. It was an easy test. And if they do badly, it's just because I'm stupid. So for all three reasons, she said, it's actually better to be an optimist. And people who tell you, you know, I anticipate bad things just because I won't be disappointed, are in fact wrong about the way human character works. So those kinds of talks were really interesting. It was worth doing. And it was a fascinating conference. I just thought I would mention it. Okay. The other thing is, you have to apply. So everybody you meet there is already vetted, and you can't just go to TED. You have to fill out this application, tell them why they should take you, and you have to spend a fortune to go there. So there are a lot of CEOs, a lot of, as I said, a lot of scientists, very interesting crowd. Anyway, all right. In one talk, I was sitting in between. On the one side was Nathan Myhrvold, who's one of the co-founders of Microsoft. And on the other side was Zagat of the Zagat guides. And I just thought, it's an interesting mix of people here. And they probably thought I got stuck next to a rabbi. but The funny thing was, everybody I talked to, their first question is, what's a rabbi doing here? As though, if you're a religious person, of course you wouldn't be interested in science or evolution or technology or design, which was just an interesting presupposition about such things. So I told them I was there to convert them. No, I didn't. By the way, a lot of Jews. The place was just, yeah, my God, it looked like a Hollywood executives convention, so many Jews. I'll tell you about one other talk, because this was the woman who just wrote a book called Quiet, about the power of introverts and introversion, and criticizing our system that assumes that people who are introverted, you know, like in class, it's always the people who speak, who you assume know the material and so on. And the whole book is about how you shouldn't necessarily encourage, or kids who go home and they go to their room and they read a book, and we think that's bad and it's unsocial, it's unhealthy. The whole book is about the fact that introversion is actually a way of being. It's not necessarily being shy, it's the way certain people are. So she brought this bag to the talk, and she talked about how when she went away to camp, right, she assumed that everybody, like she did, everybody was going to lie around in matching nightgowns and read books. And she said, when she first got there, the first thing the counselor did was she said, okay, we're going to do this cheer now, R-O-W-D-I-E. She said, and I had two questions about it. First of all, why do they want us to be rowdy? She said, I cheered because that's what you're supposed to do, but I thought, why do they misspell it? So she gave this very entertaining, wonderful talk, and then she said, and I want to show you what's in this book, and she takes out three books. The third one I recognized right away by the cover. The first one is a book by Milan Kundera, the second by Margaret Atwood, and the third was the standard English translation of Maimonides' Guide to the Perplexed. So I'm thinking, why is she taking that out? And she said, I took these three out because these were three of the favorite authors of the man who taught me how to love books, and that was my grandfather, who was a rabbi in Borough Park. So, of course, after the talk, I made a beeline to find her, and I said, Rabbi. And we started to talk, and we had a wonderful conversation, and I actually, I sent her some sources in Judaism on this subject, and then she had me post it on her blog, which I did. And I put a link on my Facebook. For those of you who want to see her blog, you can go to it from my Facebook page. Lovely person. Susan Cain is her name. Okay, so that was Ted. Completely irrelevant, but I just thought, you know. Now let's get to AIPAC. So I'm sure that many of you saw and read all the things that happened at AIPAC. The first thing that needs to be said about it is that to gather 13,000, it wasn't 13,000 Jews, right? There's a large number of non-Jews, more than you might think, who come to AIPAC just to support Israel. To have 13,000 people in one room, because in past years they had the gala was a dinner, but they didn't have enough room to put tables. So this year it was just a lecture, basically, or a speech. But to have 13,000 people in one room who support Israel is a truly stunning tribute to the United States of America. There's just never been a place like it in history. And even those places where you could gather, let's say you could, for example, in England they have Limud, where many Jews gather for Jewish study. But there would be a self-consciousness about 13,000, let's say 11,500 were Jews, something like that. There would be a self-consciousness about gathering that did not exist at all. Nobody went around saying, you know, it's a little, don't be too Jewish, or it's a little scary to be Jewish. In fact, when we came there, the protesters who were, it was all about, you know, Israeli terrorists, get out of the West Bank, stuff like that. They were the ones who seemed marginalized and foolish, and they were the ones that the police were pushing aside so that all of us could get to where we wanted to go. And when we were exiting, in fact, after the Netanyahu speech, they took us a strange route, and I didn't know why. I was wondering why they made us go out the side instead of the main entrance, and the answer was that there were 20 or 30 protesters out the main entrance, and they just didn't want us to have to bother with them. And so that unselfconscious assertion of enthusiasm and, frankly, of power, never, ever, never in history happened. And I don't know that there's anywhere else in the world that it could happen other than the United States. And not only just the United States, but in the capital of the United States, in the shadow of the White House, it was really astonishing. And from the perspective of Jewish history, beyond anything that our ancestors could ever have imagined. So having said that, there were obviously various breakout sessions, and I got a chance to talk to the major donors, i.e. give a fundraising pitch. But the highlight of the conference, or the most, by far, I don't know, highlight, depends how you define it, was obviously the president's address and the prime minister's address. And I would say a good 80% of the discussion at the conference was about Iran and the two of their treatment of Iran. So I wrote an article about it for the Washington Post that you can take a look at, but I'll give you my sense, some of which I didn't write for reasons that will become obvious in a minute. But this is what I would say. First of all, I encourage you, if you haven't done it, to read Jeffrey Goldberg's interview with Obama, which is on his blog. And Jeffrey Goldberg is a reporter for Atlantic Magazine. He served in Israel. He's one of the three or four most important non-governmental voices about Israel in the United States. I mean, his blog is very, very widely followed. He's been here a couple times. He's very smart. He knows what he's talking about. And I don't think that you can exactly identify him as left-wing or right-wing. He gets attacked from both sides. And I'm going to give you his take first officially, and then in my conversation with him, what he said to me. That he also said, I just saw to some extent, he didn't say it exactly the same way, but he said it on Charlie Rose, because he was interviewed on Charlie Rose the other night after his Obama interview, which went all over the world, the Obama interview, because he had about 45 minutes to talk just about the bombing of Iran with Obama, which is really what the conversation is about. So, first of all, here's sort of the lay of the land as I got it, and then I'm happy to open it up for conversation, but this is what I understood from the people I spoke to who were, I had a couple of different conversations. First of all, this wasn't part of the conversation, but of course I have to repeat this because a member of ours, Jonathan Greenblatt and Marjan Kapoor, who some of you know, so they moved to Washington and now he's working at the White House. So I had breakfast with him at the White House. And the chief of staff, Jack Lew, came by, who's an Orthodox Jew. I don't know if you're aware of that, that Obama's chief of staff is an Orthodox Jew. And he came by and he said hello, which was incredibly nice and very gracious. And then when he left, Jonathan said to me, you know, he won't eat in this place. He won't eat here. He's, because it's, you know, it's like a non-kosher restaurant as far as he's concerned. And in fact, he said now in the White House for the first time, you know, they have these takeaway meals that you can bring back to your desk. Because it's not like everybody leaves the White House at lunch, you know, to go to lunch at. He said, now for the first time, part of the takeaway meals are kosher. So you can get kosher takeaway meals because the chief of staff won't eat anything else. So when your chief of staff, now that doesn't necessarily, I want you to, that's not a policy point. But it is certainly true that one thing that is clear is that Obama is very comfortable around Jews and Jewish religiosity. I mean, he has a Seder each year, and Jared Bernstein, whom I met with, who's his Jewish liaison, is running the Seder this year, and they have a Chabad rabbi come in and read Megillat Esther. I mean, you know, the religious part of it, whatever you think of his political views, clearly he's very comfortable with. You don't hire an Orthodox Jew as your chief of staff if you're not. anyway, but I got absolutely no insight into anything from being in the White House, but it was fun. And I did get a box of chocolates in a little tin that they give to all the guests that you can bring home to your daughter and give it to her and say, here's a tin from the White House. Yes, exactly. That's what I thought, too. I thought the whole trip to Washington was worth that. But here's what I actually did. And I talked to Jared Bernstein, the Jewish liaison, who obviously, I mean, he's Obama's Jewish liaison. So you can imagine that his what his take on it's going to be. Nice, though, interesting, good guy. Worked for Bloomberg for a while, and now he works for Obama. Here's sort of what I got the sense of. The background of all this is that, first of all, unfortunately, everybody in the business knows that intelligence is faulty. and that you're always going to operate on faulty intelligence, and that every single time, you know, we have we've undertaken to figure out whether somebody has a nuclear device, not every single time, but many times we've gotten it wrong, and a few times we've gotten it right. Right? So, for example, we thought Saddam did, and he didn't. We thought the North Koreans didn't, and they did. So it's a very tricky proposition, and you read different accounts every day about whether the Iranians are close or not. And so part of the calculation that everyone has to make is how much of a margin of error are you going to give yourself, right? Because who knows? Because even if you have somebody in the inner workings of the Iranian government, and let's say that the Mossad does or the CIA does, how do you know the guy's feeding you correct intelligence? How do you know? How do you know he hasn't been turned? You know, all you have to do is read one of John le Carré's novels to know that even when you think you're getting the correct intelligence, it's possible that your own guy has been turned or was a spy to start with. In other words, you can't know until you know. So aerial photographs told us that the Iraqis were building the Osirak reactor. That was clear. Everyone knew it. You bombed it. It was gone. But the Iranians are not stupid, and they've learned a lot from that. So who knows? On the other hand, Saddam, you know, I heard someone who has read, which I suspect no one in this room has, and I certainly haven't, who read all the many thousands of pages of testimony that Saddam Hussein gave to various CIA interrogators before he was executed. Okay? And this was his account of why the world thought he had WMD and he didn't, at which the guy said made the most sense of any account he's read. He said he thinks Saddam was telling the truth at the end. What Saddam said was, look, we built it originally because of Iran. You guys destroyed it. We didn't want to get, we were well aware of the fact that we didn't have the military power to stand up to Israel or the United States. But on the other hand, we were well aware of the fact that if we weren't seen as building a WMD, that we were vulnerable to Iran. So we were building it so that we weren't building it, but we were saying we were building it, and we were letting out that we were building it, and we were giving signals to the whole world that we were building one, but it was for Iran, it wasn't for you. And then you guys said, we're invading because you're having it, and we didn't really think you were going to invade, because first of all, we didn't really have one. And we thought it was some kind of pretext, and so on. And that could well be. Now, let's say that that's true. It's another instance of how disinformation can actually be successful, because it's clear, whatever else you think about the Iraq War, it's clear that many people very high up, including the president, really believed that they had weapons of mass destruction, right? And it's also clear that they would have if they could have. So it's complicated. And the other factor that you hear again and again from both Israeli and American officials is that Israel has a shorter window than America does, because America has bigger planes and bigger bombs and greater military capacity. So if the Iranians are in the process of building a bomb, let's say the Americans have a year before they have to bomb, the Israelis would have 6 months or 4 months or 8 months. I don't know The question then becomes, first of all, whose intelligence do you trust? Whose read do you trust? And here, I don't think there's an easy answer, because anyone could be right and anyone could be wrong. We have no idea what resources the various countries have. And whose intentions do you trust? So the people, and I want to give you the two sides. The pro-Obama side, the you can trust his intentions. Well, first of all, they'll list all the various accomplishments that Obama has done, that he funded Iron Dome, that he that he liberated the Egyptian, the captives in Egypt, that he has given more money, there's more money been given to him to Israel security than any other president, that the generals all say the security cooperation is greater than it has ever been, all that kind of stuff. The people who distrust him partly substantively and partly symbolically, the symbolism being, you know, he didn't visit Jerusalem. He obviously seems not to get along so well with Netanyahu. He said the thing about the 67 borders and then with territorial adjustments, which was at worst tone deaf, I mean, at best tone deaf, and at worst sending a signal all those kinds of things. And the reason that this matters is, you know who the first president was who spoke of a two-state solution? George Bush was the first one to say it publicly. Now, if Obama had been the first one to say it publicly, he would have been crucified. So a lot depends on how much people trust you, what you can say, right? The same thing if he said 67 borders with adjustments, had Bush said that, I don't think it would have been. And then there is also the element, which we can't deny, there's a certain underlying, he had time in Indonesia as a child, his middle name is Hussein, and he's black. Right? Take that for what you will. Anybody who says that plays no part in it is lying to themselves. Of course it does. So here you have two leaders, both of whom face a situation that they both know is unacceptable. Right? It's not that Obama thinks that it'll be okay if Iran gets a nuclear bomb, not only because he said publicly that containment is unacceptable, but also because he enumerated at the AIPAC speech, the reasons why any sensible person, I'm here exempting the Europeans, any sensible person knows that it's completely, and the reasons are, just to give a few of them. One, because once you have a nuclear bomb, that means you can give nuclear material to proxies, which means that Hezbollah could have a small nuclear bomb courtesy of the Iranians, which, and if you think that that can't happen, just remember the Pakistanis have done that, right? There was this one guy, this one man, who from this one Pakistani nuclear scientist is responsible for the proliferation of nuclear material all over the place. So that's one thing. And anybody who has a brain knows that, you know, it's not like Las Vegas. What starts in Iran doesn't stay in Iran. It could easily go anywhere you want it to go. And then second, because all of Iran's neighbors, and everyone knows this, they don't want Iran to have a nuclear bomb any more than we do. If the Israelis bomb, they will privately be happy and publicly condemn. That's what'll happen, right? They'll all saber rattle publicly and say how awful it is, but you know, inside the privacy of their own homes, they'll be thrilled. But if the Iranians get a nuclear bomb, then you know that all these other countries are going to agitate to get a bomb as well, because everyone knows Israel's not going to use it, but they don't know that about Iran, and they will feel like they're subordinate to Iran. They will be. And third, because as I think either Obama or Netanyahu said this, I don't remember, when Iran threatened to close the Straits of Hormuz, thereby choking off the world's oil, everybody said, yeah, right. Because we all knew that that's something that Iran militarily couldn't do. But what if Iran with a nuclear bomb says we're going to close the Straits of Hormuz? Then what are you going to do? I think that Obama is perfectly aware, as any statesman would and should be, that containment is a ridiculous, unworkable strategy. However, you're now let me give you the other side. You're the Prime Minister of Israel, and this is what Jeffrey Goldberg said to me when I spoke to him about this. He said, do you know that, I don't know how many, some of you will know, the Hebrew slang word friar. Friar means to be a sucker. Okay, and it's the worst thing you can be in Israel, is to be a sucker, right? You know, the Israeli hubris. So he said he thinks Netanyahu's greatest fear, other than obviously the greatest fear, which is that Iran will get a bomb and use a bomb, is being a friar. And here's how it could happen. So Obama says to Netanyahu, believe me, we will take care of it. We've got your back. So then the general comes to Netanyahu and says, if you don't bomb, bless you, in the next week, our window is closed. The Americans can still do it, but our window is closed. So then Netanyahu gets on the phone to Obama, and Obama says, we will not let it happen. So Netanyahu tells his people to stand down. A month goes by, he calls Obama, and Obama says, I can't bomb. I won't bomb. And then it's all lost. And that's what Netanyahu was saying to the AIPAC conference, not even in a veiled way, very explicitly, which is, if the time comes that the window of Israeli bombing is about to close, I'll bomb. Because I can't take the chance. And I think that this would probably be true whoever the president was, but I think it's certainly true with Netanyahu and Obama. I can't take the chance of allowing Israel's security to be in the hands of any other leader and any other nation. That's the whole point of having an Israel, is that you do it on your own, right? I mean, otherwise, we've had the experience of having the world responsible for our security. And even though, yes, it's a different world, and yes, it's a different leader, and yes, there's kosher meals at the White House, it's still, I mean, you wouldn't want it either. You wouldn't want someone else responsible for raising your child, right? So now, Dennis Ross, who is, you know, he occupies a sort of ambiguous position, half in, half out in some ways. He's like any diplomat. He's very identified with the Jewish community and so on and so forth, but he worked for a long time as Obama's Mideast liaison. His comment was that when the Egyptian diplomats were taken, the first call that Netanyahu made was to Obama. When the flotilla was taken, the first call that he made was to Obama. And Obama backed him up on the flotilla, backed him up on the Goldstein report, liberated the Egyptian diplomats. He said Netanyahu trusts Obama when the chips are down. So what I came away from the conference thinking is everybody I met was certain and none of them know. Right? There are people who said, oh, you can't trust Obama. He's going to stab Israel in the back the first chance he gets. And I'm thinking to myself, you have no idea. You have no idea. Everybody's so selective in their reading of the evidence. When you say to them, but he did this, 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 and this, they say, well, but that doesn't matter, because believe me. And on the other side, people who say, well, obviously he's going to do exactly what Israel wants, you know, when push comes to shove, you say, but you know what, you can't, if you're the leader of Israel, you can't trust that. And they say, how can you say you don't trust the United States? Well, but the answer is because you're the leader of Israel, you're not the leader of the United States. And if you were the leader of Britain, you wouldn't hand your security over to the United States either, although NATO sort of does. But anyway, so it was a very interesting, I mean, if it weren't so consequential, you would find it fascinating, but it's very consequential. And I really, the principal takeaway, if there's a takeaway, is the one thing I'm not certain, because I just said you shouldn't be certain, but I'm extremely skeptical, much more than I was even before I went to the conference. I'm extremely skeptical that anything except for bombing could possibly work. You know, when Netanyahu said we've been doing diplomacy for 10 years, sanctions for 6 years, and look where we are, that's a very powerful argument. You know, it's and Jeffrey Goldberg had a little thing on his blog about sanctions. People talk about biting sanctions. He says, what's worse than biting sanctions? Eviscerating sanctions. I mean, it's like, how far do you go? And also the people who talk about sanctions point out that what sanctions do generally is they starve the people in the street, but they don't necessarily stop a military buildup, because a regime will always find the money for that if they want to. And their thinking could very well be, once we have a bomb, sanctions will be irrelevant and they won't be able to sustain them anyway. So it's really, and the last point I'll make and then I'll open it up for discussion is, and the last thing to say is, nobody knows for sure. And again, you get very different accounts from different experts who know. Nobody knows for sure if bombing works or how long it works for. But the sort of conventional wisdom is, if you say that bombing will delay their program by a year or two, okay? And let's say you could do a surgical strike. The other question is, what happens that if America gets involved, that America is bombing now the third Islamic country in a row, right? We invaded Iraq, we invaded Afghanistan, now we're gonna bomb Iran. It would be very hard to say, but we really are friends of the Muslim world, you know? Not so easy. And also, it depends how much destruction there is. Is it just, I mean, if you're bombing for regime change, then are we going to get another chaotic Egypt thing where the regime is not going to be more friendly? There's no guarantee that if the people who take over from the mullahs, if someone takes over, are going to be any more well-disposed towards Israel. It's not like there's a strong strain of philo-Semitism running in Iran. The other side of the conventional wisdom is, when they bombed the Osirik reactor in Iraq, they thought maybe we were only getting a year or two. But you know what? Everything can change in a year or two. So if it's a choice between letting them get a nuclear bomb or delaying it a year or two, there's no choice. there's no choice, because in a year or two, a lot can change. But once the bomb is there, and there's no turning back. So that's my 2-cent summary, and I'm happy to take, yeah.
Right. The opportunity to come in a supportive and peaceful way and do some.
So this is the really interesting question. I'll tell you the debate about that. Here's the debate about America supporting the uprising in Iran. The people who opposed America's helping said, if you want to doom an uprising in the Middle East, show them that America is supporting it. And even those who are uprising, as soon as they feel like they're doing America's work, you're going to crush it just by the fact that they're doing America's work. And the only way that an uprising in the Middle East is going to work is if it's indigenous. And Egypt is a good example. America didn't really need to support those because it was so powerful that it swept the government away. And nobody knew what was going to happen in Iran at the time. We know now that the uprising wasn't powerful enough. But we didn't know at the time. And so the administration had to make a calculation. Are we helping or hurting by supporting them? And they weren't sure. Now, in retrospect, we can say we wish they'd supported them, although we don't know that that would have worked either. But at the time, they thought, if we start saying, yeah, this is great, and feeding them material, we're gonna doom it from the start, because all the average Iranian who doesn't know which way to go, the government's going to say, you see who they are? They're all American agents. And they're going to believe them. So it's tough. Every one of these decisions that people think are easy, they're not so easy. Yeah. Still, it doesn't matter peaceful or not peaceful. The point is you would see them as an agent of America. And they were hoping that the revolt would work the way that it worked with Mubarak. What we basically did with Mubarak was said, goodbye, right? But we didn't feed material to the people in the street. Yeah. Okay. Well, that's... So that's an interesting question. There is a strain of thought that says that the difference is that for Netanyahu, once they reach the capacity to assemble, and for Obama, it is once they begin to assemble, that there's some difference in the timeline too, that Obama's willing to wait longer. That's what some people say. So I don't know. Yeah. Well, that's one strain of thought. The CIA came out with that, you know, a while ago, that Iran is bluffing, that they're not really doing this. But again, say you're Netanyahu. This is what he said. He said, if you ask the Iranians, they will tell you they're making medical isotopes. He said, of course, they have buried their medical isotope facility underground, right? And they won't allow inspectors in, and on and on. So the idea that they're making medical isotopes is suspicious at best. Now, you could say that they're doing the same thing that Saddam did, which is trying to get the world to think they have a nuclear device when they don't. But if that's what they think, it's pretty counterproductive. And they've seen that. I mean, I think that they have no illusions about the fact that Israel and or the United States will bomb them. I mean, they must know that. That was the headline from Obama's interview with Jeffrey Goldberg, is I don't bluff, mm-hmm. Right? And even if you think that Obama does, you know that Netanyahu doesn't, right? You know that Israel would not be reluctant to undertake this operation. So if the Iranians are bluffing, it's a stupid bluff. But who knows? Who knows? I suppose it is possible that they're not building. The nuclear scientist whose wife said that his goal was the destruction of Israel. I mean, there's a lot of circumstantial evidence, I think, too. In fact, it seems like, you know, there's a new round of inspections/sanctions that the Europeans have agreed to. Well, the Europeans are pretty, you know, hands off about this. So if they're convinced, then I'm assuming the intelligence is pretty strong. I don't know. Yeah.
Thinking Israel is so even-handed anyway.
Well, they only have something to lose by bombing if they do it too soon. And if they lose the sympathy of the United States, and they lose the sympathy of the European powers, and they antagonize the entire Arab world, because things could get worse, you know? It's not like Hezbollah is mobilized at the moment, but they could be, and you could coalesce the Arab world to do to act in terrorist ways all over the globe. I mean, there are lots of things that could happen if Israel doesn't wait until the last possible moment in the eyes of the world. It's always a mistake, always. I give you this piece of advice for free about life. It's true about life, and it's true about international relations. It is always a mistake to think things can't get worse. They can always get worse. And so you should never make a calculation based on the idea that things can't get worse. Right now, things in Israel are pretty quiet. And it doesn't, and you know, it's there. I mean, yes, they always are foiling terrorist plots at the border. Always, always, always. But you don't hear the volume of attempts that you did before, but you could. Yeah.
Do you feel that Obama is just waiting until after the election? He's trying to bide his time.
Well, that. So this is certainly a plausible theory. And in the Washington Post, one of the days that I was there, Mitt Romney wrote an editorial. What struck me as interesting about his editorial was he said essentially what Obama said, because there isn't that much more to say other than saying that his first visit would be to Jerusalem. But he was slightly more, actually the most belligerent speech by far was Mitch McConnell's. I don't know if you heard him. He basically said, let's bomb them because they dress funny. I mean, he was really, I'm exaggerating. But he was the most strident, let's put it that way. The reason in part that that's so, obviously apart from his views, is you have to go pretty far to go farther than Obama did in his address, right? And the thing that people criticized, I do want to say this, though, in Obama's favor, and I think, I'm not sure about, I mean, I can't read people's intentions. I can't tell you what Obama's intentions are. But I will say one thing in his favor that I think ought to be said. He said all options are on the table. And people got very upset. Some of the people around me who were talking about it, people got very upset that he didn't say, we will bomb them. The next day, Netanyahu gets up and says, people ask me what I will do, no prime minister will ever say what they will do, which was exactly what Obama did the day before by not saying what he would do. So this is a sort of, it's a mental game in a way. And the way I was listening to your friend, Emiliano, Bret Stephens, talk about this, because they had different people were standing. And if you want to hear the most coherent, intelligent, thoughtful, well-presented anti-Obama case, that's the guy to read. I tried to get him, but there were too many people around him. I couldn't tell him that you told me I need to know him. But he's the guy to read in the Wall Street Journal is Bret Stephens, and he'll give you the best. It's Stephens. You can look up his old columns online. He'll give you the best case for why you shouldn't trust Obama's intentions in this. But it's very hard to know, in part because I just want to say people are not one thing. You know, when someone, this was actually a different TED Talk. It was very interesting. There was a lawyer there. He was an African-American lawyer, and he spends his time mostly defending children who've been convicted of a crime, some of them with life sentences, and people on death row. Because he's against capital punishment. One of the reasons he's against capital punishment is he says, not that he says there aren't people who don't deserve it. He says, but one out of every nine cases that they've investigated in capital punishment has led to exoneration. He said, so that leads me to think we have a very high percentage of wrong, you know, whatever. Exoneration means they've been proved innocent. He said, so, and if somebody spends their life in prison, you still have time to find out, oops, we messed this up. Anyway, but one of the things he said that I remember from his talk, which was very powerful, is he said, people are not one thing. He said, when someone lies, they're not just a liar. Even, he said, when someone murders, they're not just a murderer. He said, and when you see people one-dimensionally, then when they do something else, you're forced to discount it because that doesn't fit. A murderer shouldn't be kind to his kids. He said, but people are lots of different things. So even if you see a politician who's been untrustworthy in ways A, B, and C, it doesn't mean that he's going to be untrustworthy in way D, and vice versa, and vice versa. That is, you might have a politician whom you like and trust and think is wonderful, and then when a crucial decision comes up, they do something that you think is terrible. And that's what makes it so devilishly difficult, is you can make the case, but people are not so consistent, and so you don't know. I mean, you don't hear very much, for example, about the fact that George Bush did more to help subdue and cure AIDS in Africa than anyone else in any other government, because it's sort of out of character with the way that we think of George Bush. But that's, people are not one thing. So anyway, if you want to see the anti-Obama case, that's the place to go. Yeah.
I just have to make a comment that
please.
It was very impressive the sheer number of delegates we had from Fannie Temple.
Yes. That's great.
And number two, they were super impressed by your talk.
Thank you.
And obviously had moderated another event.
Thank you. Yeah.
And you were just saying, "Can you talk
to your rabbi?" So look, if they put them on video, I'll put them on the Facebook page. But we had about 286 people, I think, which was by far the largest delegation. And remember also, it's not just that Jan Zakowski does such a phenomenal job, but we are the proud home to one of the founders of AIPAC, Larry Weinberg, Jan's father. So we do have a strong AIPAC tradition in this congregation, which we should be very proud of. The other thing was that I wrote an article. It was good to write right before AIPAC. I wrote an article attacking a letter that Peter Beinart sent out. This was an interesting little event. I'll tell you about, I don't think I'm gonna say anything that I shouldn't say, but we'll see. If so, I'll turn it off. So Peter Beinart wrote an article in the New York Review of Books sometime a while ago, and he's on the left side, very much on the left side of approaches to Israel. Not so left that he thinks there should be one state, but he's very critical of Israel's treatment of the Palestinians, and also thinks that Israel is alienating the American Jewish community because of that and on. Anyway, so he wrote a letter to J Street, to J Street delegates that someone sent me that I thought was not a good letter. And I wrote it appeared actually in the Jewish Journal, a very scathing response to that letter. First of all, the timing was good because obviously everybody at AIPAC was pleased. Since they are not, they're the opposite of the J Street. But also, I then received there's something called Blogging Heads TV, where on one website they have people debate issues on the website, and they called me and asked if I would be willing to debate Peter Beinart on his book, and that he'd requested that I do it. So that at least pleased me, because it's nice to not have completely alienated somebody you attacked. Yeah.
This is actually the proof of a place where we can read about the history of how AIPAC became, how becomes an American Congress.
It's a good question.
So unbelievably
I don't know if there, I'm sure there is a history. I think, someone wrote about America and Israel, not so, it was Jonathan Sarna or Michael Oren wrote a book about the history of Israel in America. I just don't remember. It's one of those two. So I think it may have been Sarna, since Sarna is the classic American Jewish historian, that is historian of Jewry in America. Probably Jonathan Sarna, and he might write about it. It seems to me there's someone else. It might have been Michael Oren. Those are the two to check. Well, this is a long, complicated issue. And you will get very different perspectives from very different people on this. I think it's fair to just say this. It is certainly fair to say that it depends how you look at it. I'll give you the two, I'll give you a summary of the two sides. The Palestinian refugee problem could have been solved a billion years ago if the Arab nations wanted to absorb the Palestinian refugees, but they don't. Okay? So the Jewish view of that is they don't because they want to use them as political means to undermine Israel. The Arab nations' view of that is they don't because these people belong in their homes in Israel and not in our countries. And if we repatriate them to our countries, we're giving up on the possibility of their ever regaining their ancestral home. We don't need to litigate that here, okay? But the one other thing that I will say, which I would like to hear a counter to, I'm sure there is a counter, I don't know what it is I'll even say it chauvinistically. If the Jews were in Gaza, I assure you that worldwide Jewish money, which is less worldwide, God knows, than Arab money, would already have built Cabo in Gaza. You know, it's a seaside resort. It could be, I'm serious. Do you know what we could build there if we were in Gaza? And there's no reason in the world why Gaza has to be a hellhole, which is what it is, with the amount of money that not only has been given, and probably all exists in Swiss bank accounts under Yasser Arafat's name, it's a very shadowy complex. And my guess is 50 years from now, someone will write a book that where our descendants will finally find out what's really gone on. The one thing I want to say is, just between us, it's not like Israel is guiltless in all this. We've done some pretty awful things over the years, and it is unsurprising, first of all, for two fundamental reasons. One is power corrupts. It doesn't matter who you are. When you have power over another human being, it blunts your sympathies. It just does. And second, remember who Israeli soldiers are. They're 17, 18, 19-year-old boys. And you and I both know what 18-year-old boys are. So give them a gun and give them power over people who are 30, 40, 50 years older than they are. And if you get a humane result, you're very lucky. But all the training in the world will not change the fact that these are kids who are running the lives of people who are much older. And that's an unhealthy situation just from the very beginning. So, anyway, yeah, you were going to say.
My takeaway from being there was that Obama, Netanyahu, Leon Panetta were all starting to frame this, not so much as what's going to happen to Israel, but what's going to happen to America.
Right.
In both not only security, but everyone's now talking about the price of gas could go up.
Which is good.
Yeah.
Not that the price of gas should go up. I mean that they're framing it in terms of not just about Israel. Right, which is very good. Which is exactly, that is a change, and that's very good. Because the more that the West realizes that this is a terrible idea for the civilized world, the better off we are. Yeah.
Both Obama and Netanyahu's speeches were electrifying. But I can't get over the difference in reception between Obama
right.
and Netanyahu.
Right.
Yeah. And as Lynn said, the likes and dislikes for Obama were split pretty evenly in the room.
Probably,
but
yeah.
But there's no one in the room that didn't like Netanyahu.
Well, I would say that's mostly true. I give it 90-10. I wouldn't say no one. But here's the other thing that I'll say, is that an individual, I mean, this was how I started the Washington Post article. An individual is smart. Crowds are stupid. If someone had gotten up and said, I'm telling you the truth, someone had gotten up and said, we should bomb Iran tomorrow, they would have cheered. Because crowds are stupid. And not only that, but when everyone around you is standing up and cheering, it's very hard to sit down. It just is, so you stand up. But there's something else. You got to realize something. I mean, everybody knows. It's not only the policy positions that Netanyahu enunciates. He's the prime minister of the Jewish state. You know, I mean, there's an emotional power to I mean, the president of the United States, it's like you feel a swell of pride, and this is our country, and he represents enormous power in the world. But the feel of history and how remarkable it is to have a prime minister, that's why you don't get ovations like that in Israel, because they're used to it, right? The prime minister says it's the prime minister. But for us, to see the prime minister of the Jewish state, I mean, I don't care who the prime minister of the Jewish state is, unless he was Stalin, I would get up and applaud wildly, because, oh my God, that's the prime minister of Israel. That's an amazing thing. Yeah.
I think also the day before, the whole ceremony that they had for Shimon Peres.
Right.
That they
was very.
It was such an amazing platform for receiving Netanyahu.
Yes, that's true.
It was very touching.
Peres was, I mean, look, Peres is, you know, in Israel, Peres has a really interesting reputation, but that he's eloquent and learned and was there at the beginning of the state and all of that, there's no question. In fact, the guy who was sitting behind me, who was a really strong right winger, and strong right wingers don't like Peres very much in Israel. You know, everybody got up and applauded, and I sort of turned around to see if he was standing up to applaud. And I was pleased to see that he was, and he saw that I looked. So he leaned over, and you know what he said to me? He said, "Without this man, Israel probably wouldn't have the atomic bomb." And he's right. And he's absolutely right. Peres was critical in that. And that was enough for him. You know, it's true that he doesn't like Peres as a left winger, but he knows that this guy, no matter how you slice it, made an absolutely historic contribution. He made many, but that historic contribution to the state of Israel, and that was enough for him. And I was like, we bonded in that, you know, in that moment, because I was concerned that he wouldn't stand up. But anyway, so it's a very, there's so many different fault lines running here. But the one thing that I will say is, I certainly wouldn't bet on politics, but if I were a betting man, I would bet that before December, let's say, probably sooner than that, but before December, in other words, at least after the election, but probably before, there'll be some kind of strike on Iran. I would be surprised, and only pleased if it was conceivable that it could be proven that a strike wasn't necessary, but I'm not optimistic, yeah. Right.
Has been
working on this for a long time.
Yep. There is strategically going on Iraq, and through Hezbollah, through the fact that even to achieve nuclear capability, no one will be safe. And I think one of the great things about this conference was that they really made sure everybody, including when the lobbies go to Capitol Hill and talk with their senators and congresspeople, they know that we shouldn't even get to that.
You know, nobody made this an app.
Right.
Well, I was going to say, nobody made this analogy, but in some ways, I wonder, actually, if somebody who actually knows the Middle East would accept this analogy. In some ways, Iran in the Middle East is like Germany in Europe. It's not just they want that power, it's the big, powerful, sophisticated country that's not actually comparable to the countries around it. It's not. I mean, France couldn't have started the Second World War. But Germany could, and the same thing's true of Iran. So you're right, it's not like bombing Iraq. It's completely different and much scarier, and you couldn't invade Iran the way we invaded Iraq. It's a very different ballgame, and that's, yeah. Okay, two last questions, and then remember, next time we start on, next time I'll give you the background so that we can start on the story of David. Because that's what we'll be doing over the next year or two, or at least until the book is finished. Yes, it's an 18-month contract, so who knows? The question is, what kind of retaliation would there be if Israel did strike Iran? You know, I don't know. I'm quoting what I've heard, is that there are a couple of possibilities. The nightmare scenario is that it would mobilize the Arab world, even though they wanted it, that it would activate all these terrorist cells all over the world who are just waiting for an excuse, and all over the world, that Jewish targets would be targets, that Western targets would be. The thing is, I read an article recently in Foreign Affairs or Foreign Policy, one of those two, and it asked why there have been so few terrorist attacks. And the answer was that we greatly overestimate the number of terrorists. That really, and they're not so competent, that it's not because our security is so great, it's because there actually aren't that many people around the world that really want to go into a building and blow it up. They got better things to do, and the ones that want to do it tend to be a little marginal. But this is exactly the kind of event that could galvanize people who wouldn't otherwise be terrorists. I mean, this is the bad scenario, and could actually, now, I don't think anybody thinks Iran then is going to invade Israel or Iran has the military firepower to threaten Israel country to country, but they could do terrible, terrible things. I mean, Hamas, Hezbollah, you know, all the various shadowy groups. There are enough groups that terrible things could happen. So that's the frightening one. Yeah.
Something that really near.
Both.
Okay, something that really touched me was when Leon Panetta said he had a Jewish roommate in college, and yeah. He would teach him the Shema every night. Oh. And then they would go on a trip to Israel, and that stayed with him. Yeah. So I was thinking that each one of us and each one of our children can be an ambassador for Jewish people.
That's right.
And that one child can be this guy who is the security,
right.
Defense security.
Exactly. To change his mind. That could be okay, very quickly, and then I want to tell you one thing that I have to tell you off tape. Right. Right. Yeah, well, that's the other thing is that, well, there's an argument, actually, whether if you attack Iran, will it consolidate the government and make them stronger, or will it weaken them? And I've heard both. I've heard people say you never have a successful attack on a country and make the country stronger. If the attack is successful, it makes the government look bad, not look good. So I've heard it said both ways. I don't know. Yeah, I call it.
I said they wouldn't let us in to hear you speak. We don't give enough money. I said, he's my
right.
rabbi.
I said, right. No, I told them you don't. I said, Lynn's going to come. Bubkiss she gives. Don't let her in. I said. No. Right, right.